are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, October 23, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Well, not just from Brooklyn, but from the Bellagio Hotel, the Raphael Conference Room. I am at the Mass Torts 2019 conference. Trial lawyers from all across the country trying all sorts of multi-district litigations involving corporate malfeasance, things like the opioids, human trafficking, and more. But also on this day, Trump, tailor-made for impeachment. Kurds given 6 days to evacuate their homes after Erdogan and Putin carve up Syria. Republicans block an election security bill. California facing blackouts as San Jose proposes a PG&E takeover. Bernie Sanders pledges to end whistleblower prosecutions under the Espionage Act. And we work, but Newman gets paid as the co-working space lays off a couple of thousand workers and gives its exiting CEO $1.7 billion.
I like the communal part of the kibbutz, but not the pay structure. That's a paraphrase, by the way. Not me just joking.
Meanwhile, Bojo gets a no-no on the Brexit vote.
Wow, Sam in Vegas.
Who knows what's next? And lastly, Zuckerberg testifies to the House on Facebook's crypto dreams. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Thanks for joining us, folks. I am in Las Vegas, as I do twice a year, and I attend this Mass Torts conference. Had a little technical difficulties this morning and a little scheduling difficulties, but we have at least a couple of guests coming by today. We have more tomorrow. Hoping to talk to people about new litigation about Juul, those things. Zantac, apparently, causes some problems. There is a I don't know if folks have remembered in the past, we've interviewed people about C8, and this was a case that Levin Papantonio, Mike Papantonio, litigated against DuPont and basically caused that company to have to fold into Dow. I think it was. They were bought. Multi-hundred-million-dollar settlement for this company just basically dumping a material used in the manufacturing of those nonstick pans. And they're supposed to burn it because it has like almost no half-life, like an incredibly long half-life. And instead they dumped it into the local river and gave 4,000 or 5,000 people all sorts of diseases, cancers, and whatnot. And out of that case, apparently, there has been another chemical that turns out to be highly problematic involving the foam that they use for runways when they're fighting fires. And we hopefully will be talking to somebody about that as well. Perhaps some of the litigation that's happening with the Boeing MAX 737. We'll see as it goes on. But first, let's just start with the impeachment. yesterday, Bill Taylor, and if you go back and listen, I can't. When was it? What, about 2 weeks ago that we got the text messages, and we read through those text messages, and they were incredibly damning. And Bill Taylor, it was quite clear from those text messages the relevance that he plays in all of this. Bill Taylor was a career diplomat who was appointed acting ambassador to Ukraine after the Trump administration got rid of the first existing ambassador to Ukraine because she was
unfair.
I guess unfair and not involving herself enough in the pursuit of Trump's looking for an investigation into Biden. And Bill Taylor is the guy who's sort of like, he's just not part of the crew. He's there. They seem to think he's going to go along with it. But at one point in the phone conversation, in the text messages he had with Sunderland, who is the hotelier who gave $1 million to Trump's inaugural ball or fund. I'm not quite sure where that money went, but he was the ambassador to the EU. He basically took over the Ukraine portfolio along with Kurt Volker and Rudy Giuliani, essentially. And Taylor, at one point in the exchanges, says, as I said on the phone last night, I think withholding security assistance to help with a political campaign is crazy. And then Sunderland was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. No one said the words quid pro quo. In fact, I just watched The Sopranos on the plane ride out here. The episode where Tony thought that his buddy was wired. And it turned out to be another guy who was wired. Mm-hmm. But it was a similar type of situation where Tony was like, yeah, sure, okay. I never said that. And Bill Taylor went and testified yesterday. All we have is his opening statement, which was released. But it's quite clear from that he, when he first got there, could not believe what was going on. And it took him a while to understand what was happening. But by the end, he realized that Giuliani, Volker, Sondland, and Rick Perry were...
Rick Perry.
Yeah.
Best people.
The best people.
This is what he says. He goes, Taylor lays out a timeline of Trump's interactions with Zelensky. This is the president of Ukraine. And the, quote, highly irregular channel of U.S. policymaking in Ukraine that included Kurt Volker, Sondland, Rick Perry, and Rudy Giuliani, who, I should remind you, does not work for the U.S. government. He works for the president of the United States as his personal attorney.
In his capacity as a simple country lawyer.
And the interesting thing about this is that, at least according to what we know from Taylor's thing, now, they are deposing people. And apparently this is the way that the first Benghazi hearings went. They deposed people behind closed doors, then they open it up to public hearings, and which makes sense. It's the same way that you would do any type of prosecution. And according to what has been reported on Taylor's testimony, it seems like they were not even necessarily asking for an actual investigation. They were asking for an announcement that there would be. To basically, obviously, to as a way of hurting Joe Biden in the general election campaign. And so the quid pro quo is indisputably there. And you know this because, and do we have Mo Brooks apparently yelling? Did you hear about this?
No.
The Republicans are now yelling about the process. Literally, I think Mo Brooks from Alabama was like in the hallway, like almost like a did his own version of like a Code Pink protest, and they are going to argue
more emoluments clause. We
exactly.
will bleed.
Fake emoluments.
Fake emoluments. Stop the prosecution.
And the
we have it.
Okay. Yeah, here is Mo Brooks. This is how you know the Republicans know they have a massive problem on this question of quid pro quo.
And this is how they are so stressed that somebody went to Donald Trump and was like, "You can't do the G7 in your frigging hotel, dude."
Right, right. That's a bad move right now, Chief. And but they know how bad this is, Bill Taylor is, in this point. And so they're going to talk about process because they're very concerned with norms. And here's Mo Brooks.
Mr. Brooks, the opening statement says very clearly, this is not, this is
okay,
what Bill...
The opening hold statement doesn't make any difference.
Let me finish what I'm saying. Let me finish my question.
Look,
he says very clearly...
You should not be relying on it.
Why
you
should not be relying on his public testimony?
If you were in a court of law, would you rely just on the opening statement of an attorney?
But let me
or
ask
the first
you,
witness
can
call?
I ask you what
or would
he
you
said?
Have cross-examination? Would you allow rebuttal witnesses to determine, to explore whether the first witness's testimony
about the
was accurate and correct?
I'm asking about the substance of what he said. He
said that... Any difference. We don't know whether what he said is true or not because of the sham process that's being used.
There's the sham process.
Oh my God, he's aging the entire Republican caucus.
Yeah, and this is a big problem for them. This is going to be a big problem for them. And the next question is just simply going to be, how are the Democrats going to handle this? We see numbers on impeachment are up, all except for Trump's base. Which is highly problematic for the Republicans. And this is, it's just a question of timing now and what other articles of impeachment they bring in. We'll get to those other clips in a moment.
Whoa, Mo, calm down. Sell it later.
Folks.
Doesn't look good.
It's of course it's nice to be here in the Bellagio Hotel, but the sad part is I don't have my calming comfort blanket. It's true. I don't sleep as well without it.
I 100% believe you.
That's just I don't. And for you folks, there's no need to suffer through another sleepless night. Thank you to Calming Comfort by Sharper Image. It is a weighted blanket that helps you fall asleep and stay asleep naturally. It's made with that super soft velveteen material. It's designed with high density comfort fill, which mimics the soothing feeling of being hugged or swaddled, and provides exactly the right amount of weight to help relax your body. Meanwhile, the ThermaComfort neck and shoulder wrap uses clay beads to provide the perfect amount of pressure to relax the muscles in your necks and your shoulders. I have gifted one of those, and they love it. They absolutely love it. If you're someone who likes to get massages, and you like pressure on your shoulders, I personally I'm not a fan of that. but for me the weighted blanket now is. A must-have. I'm sleeping with the window open. Keep it nice and cool. Weighted blanket. I fall asleep. I stay asleep. And the Calming Comfort weighted blanket comes with 90-day anxiety-free best sleep of your life guarantee from Sharper Image. Right now, just for our listeners, you can go to calmingcomfortblanket.com. Use the promo code MAJORITY. At checkout and receive 15% off the displayed price. Again, that's calmingcomfortblanket.com, promo code MAJORITY. You can't put a price on a great night's sleep, so go now to calmingcomfortblanket.com. Use the promo code MAJORITY. And as I have said in the past, hiring can be an incredibly slow process. This guy, Cafe Altura's CEO, Dylan Miskowitz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. He switches to ZipRecruiter. Boom. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. So you get qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for all business sizes. You can try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Okay, and now joining me, you can see on camera, and Jeff, if you could just move right over here, we get you in the camera's view here. Joining me now is Jeff Gaddy. He is an attorney with Levin Papantonio. And Jeff, I think we spoke last time. Last time I was here. Oh, here. I'm sorry. Let me get you. All right. Why don't you just try that one there?
Yeah. Yeah. We did. We spoke about a year ago about the opioid stuff.
Okay. Sorry. Give me one more second. Okay. Give me that now. All right. So Jeff, I think we spoke a year ago about.
We did.
Okay. And so, give me a sense. You're working on the opioids. Just refresh. Everyone's memory as to what you're working on, what part of there's various litigations going on across the country.
Sure.
There's just a settlement in Ohio. I mean, tell us about what's going on.
Sure. So we represent several hundred local governments in litigation against the manufacturers and distributors of opioids. It's to kind of boil it down to its simplest terms, it's a supply and demand type of case. We allege that the manufacturers of opioids misled the doctor and patient community and drove up the demand for opioids by falsely telling folks that they were not addictive and that they were safe. And the distributors, they were right there with the supply. In spite of duties that they had to be on the lookout for and report suspicious orders of opioids, they continued to just flood the market with these pills that has led to so much addiction and other consequences, death that we've seen with these. So that's the basis of the litigation.
So are there two sets of defendants here? The manufacturers, who include what? Purdue and
sure. So that's the Purdue, the Johnson & Johnson, Endo, Mallinckrodt. A lot of these big branded and also generic manufacturers. And then on the other hand, you have the distributors.
And there's three major ones, right?
So there's three major ones that most folks, I'd never heard of them until I got into this litigation. But then you look into them, and they're Fortune 15 companies.
Wow.
So they are very well funded. McKesson, Cardinal Health, AmerisourceBergen. And so they're the kind of the traditional distributors. And then you have a lot of folks who you and I would probably just think of as pharmacies, Walgreens, CVS, Walmart. What these companies did was 15, 20 years ago, they realized that hey, instead of paying the premium for having one of these big three distribute us our drugs, we can go out, get our own DEA license, and just distribute to ourselves. So those folks have attempted to brand themselves as simply pharmacies, but they also have a distributor license, which obviously subjects them to the same duties and rules and regulations
and
as the others.
And that's the key there, because once they assume the responsibility of a distributor, there are statutory obligations that they have that are specific to the distributors, right? Just explain that, because and at one point, one of the stories was, I don't know if this was about 4 or 5 years ago, they were lobbying hard to get those statutory obligations eased. Because I think they knew they were headed for a problem here.
You're absolutely right. So the Controlled Substance Act has been on the books since 1970. And it's been there for decades, where they have this duty to be on the lookout for and report anything that doesn't pass the smell test when it comes to orders of pills. Quantity.
Okay, so they're using data, and they have you know, the functional equivalent, I guess, of actuarial tables for what they anticipate the usage of drugs are going to be in any specific region or wherever it is, distribution center they have.
What we've learned is these folks have data about data. I mean, they have visibility from the top to the bottom. And what they're charged with under these rules and regulations is utilizing that data to make sure that they're not supplying pill mills, to make sure that only legitimate prescriptions are being filled. And the allegations in the case are that these folks have completely missed the ball when it comes to their duties and rules and regulations.
Okay, and so so that's basically, and so who are your plaintiffs? I mean, who are your plaintiffs in this instance?
So local governments, cities, counties, towns, boroughs, any local government. And one of the big calls to arms here was, you know, kind of harkens back to the tobacco litigation. And there was a $247 billion settlement in tobacco. It was completely driven by the attorney generals. And a lot of that money went to fix potholes and build highways. And what we saw in this case was that the damages were really felt on a local level. It was the cities and towns who were dealing with their citizens who were becoming addicted, who were trying to fund treatment centers, and they just weren't able to do so. So represent hundreds of local governments who are fighting to get funding so that they can address the opioid impact locally and try to make a difference in their individual communities.
And this is, and the impact ranges from dealing with future addicts
it's all of the above. We talk about trying to gather funds to abate this public nuisance, this epidemic, and we talk about it very, very globally. Obviously every location is different. We would never tell anybody how to spend any funds they recover for this, but education is a big thing. I mean, we've seen that with the tobacco, where the ads are finally starting to roll out from the tobacco litigation. So we think that's important, that you should be in the elementary schools teaching kids that the pills in their parents' medicine cabinet are just as dangerous as a needle, and if a heroin needle goes into their arm one time, it won't be the last. We think law enforcement and jailing, I mean, those infrastructures are so stressed by this crisis. So we don't think this is a problem you can arrest your way out of by any stretch of the imagination, but law enforcement, we've had a couple of instances where we've had law enforcement officers overdose on the side of the road searching vehicles because the fentanyl can be absorbed through the skin. And you have officers who are searching a car on the side of the road, touch fentanyl, absorbs through their skin, and they overdose on the side of the road.
Oh, my God.
So, thankfully, those officers have been revived, and it has. We haven't lost one, but that should never happen. That should never happen. So, making sure that all law enforcement officers have the resources to kind of appropriately deal with this issue. And then, of course, the biggest bucket would be addiction treatment services. So that it's needed. I have yet to be to a community, and I've been to hundreds of them now working on this case. And I've yet to be to visit a community that tells us we have empty beds. We have space available. Nobody does.
Right.
They're all maxed out. They all have waiting lists. They have people on waiting lists who overdose and die, and that's something that shouldn't happen. And that's what we're trying to fix with this litigation.
Okay, so what is the status now? How is this? Is this related to what's happened in Ohio? Is that just two specific districts? Like, you know, because they're it feels like every other day we hear a different report of a different settlement.
Sure.
Maybe one just with Johnson & Johnson, maybe one that is just for specific counties.
So what you're seeing is an example of the lesson that trial pressure brings about resolution. And as a trial lawyer and as a firm that tries a lot of cases, that's something that we know better than anybody. So what we're seeing here is we had a trial that was supposed to start Monday. I was supposed to be in Cleveland, not here, but Monday morning the case settled. There was several defendants that entered into a settlement, several others that were severed out and will probably go to trial in the next couple of months. But that's what we're seeing is all the local government cases, the ones filed in federal court and consolidated up in Cleveland, Ohio, in front of Judge Polster. And this was the first trial that we'd been building up to for the last 2 years. As I said, trial.
So how many plaintiffs,
resolution.
How many cities or municipalities, whatever it is, I mean, the towns, I mean, how many of those are participating in this settlement?
There's about, in the settlement, it's just the two trial counties. So Judge Polster determined that Cuyahoga and Summit counties, which is where Cleveland and Akron sit, were going to be the two counties to go to trial first. So as the trial date was set, we saw the dominoes start to fall. You had Insys file for bankruptcy. You had Purdue file for bankruptcy. As we started getting closer and closer to trial, Johnson & Johnson settled with the two counties. Mallinckrodt, another big manufacturer, settled with the two counties. And then literally at the 11th hour, we had the big three distributors, McKesson, AmerisourceBergen, and Cardinal Health, settle with the two counties. So
these two counties were suing, like, it sounds like a half a dozen players, more.
I think the list was about 20 to 23.
Oh, okay. And so, they're bringing this case against all those plaintiffs contemporaneously, or
against all those defendants? Yes.
Those defendants contemporaneously.
Yes.
So, how did the defendants organize themselves? Or were you going to have, if you went to trial on behalf of those two counties, and there's 20 defendants,
mm-hmm.
do they have like 20 different legal teams that are arguing this?
They do. And look, Judge Polster is a fantastic judge and has done a great job managing this case. And one of the things he did about 4 months ago was say, we don't have room in the courtroom for 23 defense attorneys. So we essentially split the case in half, severed out approximately 8 to 10 of them, said that'll be a second trial. And so then we moved forward with about half the number that we started with. And we saw the results of that. Once they knew that there was focus and attention on them, the settlement started to roll in.
And can you tell us what the numbers are on that settlement?
Sure. They've been publicly reported. So Mallinckrodt, which is a big manufacturer, branded and generic, paid about $20 million. The big three that settled on Monday paid a total of about $210 million is what's been reported there. Teva is a big manufacturer based in Israel, but they have some entities here in the U.S. It's been reported they paid about $5 million on Monday. Fairly substantial numbers.
So you're talking almost about $250 million between these two counties.
Sure.
And so, and presumably, they have a split in between, between them, and then this money goes into those various services that they need. Now, how these counties end up spending that money is up to them.
Absolutely,
right, okay.
And Cuyahoga County's already announced that they've formed a specific task force to focus on exactly what the needs are in their community, which is what we've been preaching for the last 3 years.
Okay, so now, what does these settlements, do they basically establish benchmarks and an algorithm for the way that other counties, municipalities will ultimately presumably settle?
Sure. I mean, that's the whole purpose behind setting some of these early, what they call bellwether trials, to kind of test the waters and see what how a defendant values a case when it comes to settlement, or how a jury values a case. And obviously, we talked about the numbers. They've been reported. They're significant. So the fact that these folks were ready to put that type of money on the table shows what they were concerned about as far as a jury verdict.
So how will that, and then presumably when these, we move down the line with these other counties and municipalities, it's some type of formula like Cuyahoga County had X number of people and had reported X number of ODs and has a budget of Y, and these many pills ended up in this county over the course of 15 years, and relative to the $125 million they're going to get, that's what sets the formula.
Sure. So there's a bunch of different data points you could look at as far as metrics for determining something like that. What we've kind of focused on is amount of pills, which you referenced, and we're actually looking at it in MMEs as opposed to just pills. So morphine.
MMEs?
Yeah, morphine milligram equivalents.
Okay.
So that's kind of how, you know, you have a hydrocodone pill and an oxycodone pill. They're both just one pill, but the oxycodone pill is 50% stronger.
Right.
So that's what we're looking at is potency. So we're looking at MMEs going into communities. We're looking at overdose deaths. We're looking at diagnoses of opioid use disorder. So how many folks are addicted in the community? And those are the three data points that we've kind of focused in on the most.
So presumably we're going to start hearing about settlements cascading over the next like 6 months.
You know, it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. As I've said a couple times, trial pressure brings about resolution. In Cleveland, there's no more trial dates right now. So we expect there will be one rollout soon. If you remember, I told you about half of the defendants were severed out. So we do expect there to be a trial date for those folks that'll roll out soon. And we'll work those cases up aggressively. We'll prepare them for trial. And if the defendants make an offer that our client tells us to accept, then we'll accept it. But otherwise, we'll go and try the case, which is what we are prepared to do starting this week.
Now, are there other sets of plaintiffs out there that are pursuing other litigations? Are attorney generals involved in this anymore? Or?
Sure. So I think Nebraska is the only holdout. I think otherwise every attorney general has either brought a case or announced the intention of bringing a case and retained counsel. You have cases that have been filed.
Why Nebraska? Is McKesson located in Nebraska?
No, they're a San Francisco-based company out in California. I don't know. I don't know what's going on in Nebraska. But for whatever reason, they've decided to stand on the sidelines so far. You have hospitals that have filed cases trying to seek reimbursement for you know, indigent patients that they've treated who've come in with overdoses and things like that. You have third-party payers who are filing lawsuits claiming that they were the benefits and risk of opioids were misrepresented to them. So it's complex. There's a lot out there. The local government cases and the attorney generals seem to be kind of leading the charge, but
What happens when the Purdue, for instance, says we're bankrupt? Are they bankrupt? Are they protecting themselves? Like, where does a settlement, or where would a court order essentially, where would that sit relative to the other creditors that they're getting bankruptcy protection from?
So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. So they filed a Chapter 11 bankruptcy. They've been very public about their willingness to reorganize, to spin the company off, to rename it, to use the bulk of any funds that they have available.
Is there any type of like recourse in that situation? I mean, it seems like the idea that you could sue this company for doing what they did in, you know, marketing this and manufacturing it and having an obvious awareness that this seems like a really successful product and it shouldn't have been this big.
Right.
And earning $1 billion more.
Well, let's be clear. It wasn't an accident.
Right.
It was as big as it was because of the actions that they took.
Of course.
Everything was strategic. Everything was intended.
And then they just say, well, we're going out of business. The C-suite, the Sacklers, they walked away with all the cash. The business is just a sort of, presumably just sort of like some type of shell, right, essentially. And they're going to restructure. They're just going to be they're going to change their name and, you know, move out of town.
So it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. There was recently a temporary stay entered, meaning kind of a pause on all the litigation against both Purdue, their affiliated entities, and also the Sackler family. And the court gave everybody until the first week of November to kind of decide what type of discovery would be permitted onto the financial status of both the company and the Sackler family. So those negotiations are happening now. And obviously that's a huge question. How much money did because it's a private company. They don't have, you know, they don't have these public filings. They don't have the E3s that, can you
go to the bankruptcy court and say, you can't allow them bankruptcy protection or.
So there's a lot of different vehicles available. I think that if these negotiations come out favorable to us and we're able to get the transparency that we think we're entitled to, then you know, we might be satisfied with that. And that's what we want to know. We want all the cards on the table, and we want to be able to see the full picture before we enter into negotiations. So that's what's happening now.
Why would they agree to do that?
Well, I think they know that the judge is fully aware of the entire situation. He hasn't been living, you know, in a box for the last decade. So he knows the history. It's very public. He knows about the crisis.
Ultimately, they're satisfying the judge. And for the judge to be satisfied, both parties need to come and say, like, we've made an agreement. And if they don't satisfy the judge can get more onerous about what.
The judge was very clear that the stay he put on any litigation against them was temporary.
Okay.
And that was he harped on that several times, that it's a temporary stay. And I think that if the Purdue and the Sacklers had their listening ears on, they heard that and they knew that they need to come to a fair outcome. By the first week of November, and allow everybody to see
just how much money they've walked away.
Exactly.
Profiting off of the abject misery and suffering they've caused. Hundreds of thousands of people across the country?
I have no quibbling with that number at all.
Yeah. Wow. Is there anything else that we should know about it? Or
so, you know, we're all geared up. We're ready to roll with trial this week, and then when the settlements happen, we're kind of press pause for about a day, and now we're already hitting the ground running when it comes to the second trial case. We kind of have what we're calling track B up in Cleveland.
So you're from Florida,
absolutely.
And you thought that you were going to be in Ohio for the next 3 to 6 months.
Yes.
And now you're in Florida.
You know, fortunately, Judge Polster was pretty good about putting reasonable limitations. So I was going to be home by Christmas. But yeah, absolutely. So we were expected to be up in Cleveland this week and for the next several weeks, right, as we put on this case against these folks. So
Jeff Gaddy, Levin Papantonio, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks,
really,
Sam.
Interesting stuff. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, folks, anticipating a... Okay. Okay. We'll have another guest is going to be joining us in just a moment. Let's look at this clip as we're talking about... And I think we're going to see this. We're going to see the attempts by the Republicans, by the Trumpistas, to the way that they're going to be able to deal with impeachment, or the only way that they have is through process, or simply saying, we have no quibble with the facts as you've presented them. It's just that, what makes you think it's wrong to do this? And here is Matt Whitaker. He is the former acting attorney general. I don't know if people remember, he was the one who stepped in after Sessions, and then everybody said, like, you can't have this guy be your attorney general.
He had some type of hot tub business. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know if people remember it. I think, was it like a multi-level marketing thing?
In retrospect, I think I would have rathered that idiot as opposed to Bill Barr, who is...
Word, without a doubt.
Significantly more intelligent, but equally, if not more... evil. But here is Matt Whitaker explaining his theory of the case to Laura Ingraham.
I really go back to that. They never saw him as legitimate. The insurance policy of Peter Strzok failed. Mueller failed. And now they're on to the next thing.
Well, and he's, again, he's, you know, these global elitists, these careerists have made promises to our, and have set in place a world establishment that operated a certain way. And President Trump has asked questions like, why do we do this way? Why don't people pay? Why doesn't Germany and France, why don't they pay 2% into NATO? And these kind of questions, which again has completely upset the apple cart, he is being punished for this. And again, I'm a former prosecutor, and what I know is this is a perfect time for a preliminary hearing where you would say, show us your evidence. What evidence of a crime do you have? I mean, the Constitution, you know, sort of abuse of power is not a crime. Let's fundamentally boil it down to, you know, the Constitution is very clear that this has to be some pretty egregious behavior. And they cannot tell the American people what this case is even about right now, because they have to do it in secret.
Yeah, and I'm reading this Bill Taylor opening statement, and my first reaction was, anything that's 15 pages, single space, it's like someone who has to put their resume on 2 or 3 pages. That's never someone you want to hire, right, by the way.
Nerd.
Okay, first off, the idea that presidential abuse of power would not be an impeachable offense. I mean, it's not a specific offense. It's a category of offenses that you would impeach for. I mean, that's the whole point, is literally you have abused your power as president.
No, therefore, that's what the global elites would have you believe.
Yeah. That's the
that's the old model.
Careerist right there.
Yeah. How many pages is your resume, Sam?
To be honest with you, I don't know that I've ever had a resume. But with that said,
that's an
alpha
move.
It is sort of stunning that they can only rely on the fact that it's single spaced and 15 pages long, as opposed to talking about any of the substance in there. In other words, we've got a guy who is so detail oriented, and Taylor apparently took copious contemporary notes, as apparently,
because he's a tryhard.
He's trying to impress people. This is something apparently like career diplomats do all the time, and I think he was particularly sensitive to what was going on, and decided to take these notes as a way of protecting himself. And the idea that this would be the way that they're going to impeach, I mean, it's like the ACA, they did the same thing with the Affordable Care Act. Like, it's 100 pages long. Who needs a bill that's 100 pages long? It's that type of thing. But that's a tough sell.
Globalist diplomats took notes. It's a new world.
You can't believe any testimony that has been typed out single space.
Let me ask you a question. You're going to trust somebody in a criminal proceeding who took notes about the crime? Please.
Meanwhile, the rats are really desperately trying to scurry off the ship, I think. And God knows what is happening in the Pence home. Yes, Mother. It's just a matter of time. It's just a matter of time, Mother. Here is Mike Pence.
There's a lot happening in the Pence home.
Yeah, here's Mike Pence, also on Laura Ingraham, talking about how, like, he had no idea about any of this, but I stand with the president.
But there's no question that when President Trump said we were going to drain the swamp, that an awful lot of the swamp has been caught up in the State Department bureaucracy. And we're just going to keep fighting it. And we're going to fight it with the truth. I mean, the American people can read the transcript of the phone call the president had with President Zelensky, and they will see there was no quid pro quo. And with regard to Ukraine, we were standing strong with Ukraine against Russian aggression, where the last administration was only sending them blankets. We're sending resources, we're sending missiles, we're going to make it possible for our ally in Ukraine to be able to to defend themselves and restore peace.
Were you ever uncomfortable with Giuliani's role in kind of getting involved in some of this? I mean, it's not against the law.
My involvement with Ukraine was all directly from my conversations with the president and, frankly, my conversations on the phone and in meetings with President Zelensky. And what I can tell you is that throughout all of that, we were focused on ensuring that the United States was standing with Ukraine for its territorial integrity against Russian aggression, and that we were supporting and encouraging Ukraine to deal with years of corruption and calling on European allies to do more to support the Ukrainian people.
So, in other words, I didn't do anything that the president didn't directly instruct me to do. And so I wasn't involved in any of this.
Laura, you'd probably be familiar with the Eichmann defense.
Yeah, exactly.
You in particular would probably be very aware of a certain trials that happened.
Yeah, I had no idea what was happening. And I have to say this, too, about Mike Pence, that in the event that we do get some type of impeachment and he becomes the president and has to run again, I find it hard to believe that people are going to be able to watch him talk for more than, like, literally 60 seconds. The guy looks like he's on the brink of crying every time he says something. It's very uncomfortable.
Much more comfortable. I mean, I don't think it's going to happen, but Pence would be obviously better to run against than Trump. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
I think so. And you know, all the concerns that people had a year or two ago about a Trump administration, I think we have had largely a Trump administration. I mean, excuse me, a Pence administration. We have the judges that Pence wanted. We have the entire agenda from the EPA to the USDA, the administrative state destruction. I think we largely have had the Pence administration during this time, but. Joining me
get
now.
Get that message to Trump. He'll be fired immediately.
Exactly. So back here in the conference, Mass Torts 2019, joining me now is Carissa Phelps. She is of counsel with Levin Papantonio. Carissa, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Would you just step
sure.
in just a little bit here? Thank you.
Yes, a lot of background noise.
Yeah. And just going to bring you down just a little bit. So, okay, you are working on human trafficking.
Anti-human trafficking, yes.
Okay. Can you tell us about, are there plaintiffs, defendants? What?
There's so many. I mean, there's so many people that we have not gotten in touch with yet to represent that need to know their rights. That's where we're at right now. And we know that we have clients that are signing up, that want to sign up, that as soon as they're educated just a bit about what their rights are, they're able to go forward and file some claims against hotels that really knew and should have known that they were harboring sex trafficking, that they were allowing it to happen. Other companies that were also helping to arrange it and profiting off of it through websites and other means. And financially, the people who are financially supporting, you know, child pornography, child sex trafficking, kind of same groups of individuals. And all of those people that make it possible and make it profitable for sex trafficking to happen, that's what we're going after. After 10 years of doing advocacy myself on the ground level and realizing we just can't rescue every single victim all the time and offer them all the services that they need, we have to stop making more victims.
Okay. All right. So, so let me just go back here and we'll work through that. So the main defendants are hotel chains or specific hotels?
Yeah, I mean, you see brands, like big brands that are out there, and some of them run and operate and own their places, their organizations. Some of them franchise them out and try to say they have no liability because they're franchised. But they're putting their brand on that, and they're doing a lot
of
control.
So are we talking, like, I mean, can you say who the defendants are? Are they, like, what brands? Yeah, like,
Well, Motel 6 is a big one, and that's owned and mostly operated by G6 Hospitality, which is owned by a private equity firm, pretty much investments are made through pension funds. So when you track the money where it goes from, it's kind of interesting because it's a full circle of these investments. These investment managers are putting money into organizations where the people's retirement funds, who they're investing,
yes,
are actually either their children are being hurt at these motels, right? Or law enforcement, they're going in trying to help and battle this problem, and they don't realize that it's their retirement dollars, their money, actually funding this activity by being... They don't realize they're right. Owners. They're owners of this as well, in terms of that. So, okay.
So let's take Motel 6, but I imagine there's other chains, obviously.
Yeah.
And we can get to the franchisee a question. And I wonder if the National Labor Relations Board, their ruling in regards to like McDonald's, does that have any sway? Do you know what I'm talking about? The relationship between franchisees and franchisors, does that have implications in this at all? Or,
I mean, I think that you might have to show that somewhat they had some activity going on. But the issue with the motels, not unlike the fast food industry, is that a lot of the people work there for a very short time. Like these employees, the maid services, even the general managers, it's like they're there and they're gone. And so really, who holds liability in that case, right? Who's the responsible party? Is the larger brand? It is.
Okay. And so how did they, what is the theory here that they knew?
That they knew or should have known?
And maybe before you tell me what they knew or should have, what was it that was taking place? I mean, what, like, specifically?
Sure. So when traffickers use hotels, and I consider traffickers either buyers, actually the people that people call Johns, right, to try to humanize them, people who purchase sex, that go in and rent rooms for the purpose of assaulting someone, and in the case of children, child sexual abuse, child sexual assault, when they rent those rooms from the motels, they're giving them a financial benefit. So that part of it is where they have their liabilities. They're taking money from people that they know are about to use their room for this activity.
And somebody
is hurt, right?
And how do you establish that they know?
That they knew or that they should have known? Because of the number of, sometimes it's the number of police calls, but oftentimes police stop responding. It's actually pretty sad. The worse that it gets at a motel location, the most rampant areas of sex trafficking, they'll stop responding, and that mostly staff doesn't want them to respond sometimes because it takes a ding. The motel will take a ding or get a fine or be at risk of being shut down or be at risk of being criminally held liable from the city attorney's office. So sometimes the calls are not made to law enforcement that should be, and then sometimes they're ignored. You have multiple reports that come out of it, police investigations, trafficking cases where specific locations are named again and again.
I see. So someone is either other guests at the hotel or
you can go on TripAdvisor and pretty much put in prostitution or trafficking and other types of crimes, and you'll see if a motel or hotel. So they are aware that this is all going on.
So it is at least primarily a function of the criminality that's been found there in the past.
And that people are being hurt. I mean, we're not just talking about bags of drugs, which are harmful. We know that, right? That if we were seeing a drug den going on, we would be appalled, and we should be appalled. But we're talking about children being raped again and again, over and over, and there being information that gives knowledge, really. I mean, really gives some actual knowledge that this was happening, and that they're ignored. They're considered, the children that are out there, disposable by these companies, and the companies have made profits, and the children, if they live to be adults, if they get that opportunity to live to be adults, live with immense pain, aren't able to trust.
Right.
Don't go on and feel safe in the world, right? And then imagine seeing all these Motel 6 or other branded motels and hotels and these lies they tell about how safe they are and that they're family friendly and that they're a good, you know, good place to be. And hearing that, if you've been victimized there repeatedly.
Now, you started in activism that was a function of having been a victim yourself.
That's personal. No, it's a very personal story because I tried to get totally away from it. I went to school. I went to college. I was a math major. I was so far away from trying to think about my past. And when I went to law school, I was focused on business law. I wanted to figure out how to make sure that capital is used in a way that really helps, right? Like we can use capital in a way that can promote social good. And so that was my focus. And when I came out of law school and business school with the JD MBA, I went in back to the streets where I had been kidnapped when I was 12 years old. I went back to the places, and it was still happening almost two decades later in the same places rampantly. And pretty much all I could see being the solution at that point was a bulldozer. I mean, we need to just have these properties taken out of these communities and plan safe communities with as much destruction that has happened in these neighborhoods for as many years as it's gone on. You really need to invest in that much more, right? Right. You have to really make it the best type of place. So I attempted to do that back in the areas where I had been trafficked, where it was still happening.
Now, where was this?
In Fresno.
Fresno, California.
Fresno, California. Yeah. And unfortunately, the whole crisis happened. The financial crisis happened. We weren't able to raise the money we needed to really buy. At that point, I just wanted to buy the properties and just take them down, right? So I went into just community neighborhood activism, raising awareness, because a lot of people didn't understand what the issue was. I had a county supervisor in Fresno County tell me that every community needed a place where you could buy sex and drugs. And to my face. And that was the attitude. And that is the attitude in many communities, that as long as it's kept over there and it's away from me, right? And we don't think about, though, what drives it and the profits that drive it. And that's what we're really trying to think for the plaintiffs.
Can you tell me a little bit more about your story? Or is
sure. No, I wrote a book about it, so
okay,
I'm
okay.
I'm pretty open about it, and it motivates me. I think that's the important part, is it motivates me to do what I do. I know that I got off the streets for a purpose, for a reason, and when I was there, I met people, I saw things I was a part of. I was, you know, myself, like I said, kidnapped, assaulted,
so
sold.
You were kidnapped and... Were you living in Fresno at the time?
So I was considered an out of control youth at 12 years old, a runaway. I had some unaddressed traumas that had happened when I was 11 years old and younger, and because of that, and because of a lack of counseling and resources and education, where I lived in a small town called Coalinga. The recommendation and advice that my
That's
mother
in California
was given,
as well.
Yeah, Coalinga, California, in Fresno County. The recommendation and advice my mother was given was to take me to juvenile hall and drop me off, which a lot of kids are, that happens to them. They go in, they go into the system then, they go into group homes, they get recycled through group homes, they, you know, and for chronic runners who are traumatized, they just end up back on the streets. Then somebody picks them up, says, and this is what happened in my story, right? I'll take care of you if you take care of me, with full intention of keeping me at a motel and me being that person's sex slave at 12 years old. And because it happened to me, I know how true it is, right? And even like when I finally got out of it, when I got to be able to get my education, get back in school, I had missed 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. I went back to school. Graduated high school, went to community college, went to college, and I thought to myself, I'm going to write checks to programs that help kids in another country that this happens to. I did not realize how rampant it was, even though it happened to me and I knew other girls that were out there. I didn't realize how rampant it was and how it had gotten not just the same, that it stayed the same, but it had gotten much worse.
And is your story, like, typically how it happens in this country, that it's kids who are falling through the cracks?
Anyone could be a victim. I mean, we say it's definitely an equal opportunity destroyer. It can reach anyone, any household, any age group, any gender as well. And so I particularly was vulnerable, and there'll be vulnerabilities that are preyed upon, like being, you know, someone people are not looking for. Even though I was missing, I was a runaway, I was reported missing, nobody was really looking for me. I wasn't a milk carton kid, right? So that leaves some vulnerability. No one will know. And it's how serial killers actually choose their victims a lot of times, is if they are considered sex workers or prostitutes, and they're not going to be looked for.
How did you get out of that situation?
So I had been taken from one person to another, which often happens. Like, you could either be thinking that you're going to be getting something better. So I went with someone else who was saying he would get me out of it. He was more violent, hurt me more, held me, and was actually probably taking me to murder me when we were pulled over by a law enforcement officer who recognized me as a... I mean, he potentially saw me that I was out of place in this
right.
car. And unfortunately missed that there was another 15-year-old girl next to me. She did not get any help. And I, my help was being arrested and taken to juvenile hall and spending 30 days in juvenile hall. And that was my escape from that trafficker. It didn't mean that trafficking was over, unfortunately. It continued. It continued until later in my life, and I was able to finally turn things around and go to, like I said, get back to school at 15 and start to see a brighter future for myself.
Those 30 days was the beginning, because then you became aware of what was going on?
No, I'd say it got worse after that 30 days.
Well, so then how did you get...
So I ended up getting in more and more trouble, crimes, gangs, partly for protection too. More sexual assaults, more trafficking happened, because once somebody knows that you've been a victim of prostitution or trafficking, then you become a target, actually more of a target for it, again and again. So that happened. I was targeted. And then when I was in juvenile hall for the longest period was 6 months, and I met a counselor he was a very positive influence in my life. He's still in my life today, who told me I had potential. He allowed me to write a journal. He got me counseling, therapy, like the whole mix of things that I needed. Encouraged me to have a relationship with my mother, and helped me to really heal in a way that didn't just immediately rescue me, because that's
right.
not what happens. But it started. That was like a pivot point where it started, that I had a new message I could play in my mind, which was, you have potential, instead of the other messages.
So is the dynamic for... obviously, you know, it's not true for everybody, but is the dynamic for kids who are in that situation that they, it's not necessarily that they are physically kept from leaving, that it's just that they don't see any other options?
It could be either.
To their life?
Yeah, it could be either. I mean, you could be, have that physical, you're trapped.
Right.
I mean, especially imagine as a child, you're 12 years old, you don't drive a vehicle, you can't get out.
If right. I go, you don't even
if I go
know
out
where you
of
are.
This motel,
right.
even if he opens the door and tells me to leave, I'm thinking, okay, there's somebody worse waiting for me out there.
Right, you just don't know.
Yes.
Yes.
So you have that element of being trapped. Which I think is almost a physical barrier to getting out of it. And then you have the emotional and mental pieces of it, that you don't trust people. Clients that, you know, were raped by police officers, assaulted by police officers who they thought were going to help them. And
right.
so that's not the majority of law enforcement that's out there. And I work closely with law enforcement, so I don't want to paint that picture. But it happens, and it has happened. And so...
Wow. And so what... I guess, so when you look at something like Sesta Fosta,
mm-hmm.
Which is a little bit off topic here, because I do want to go back to, you know, how you're establishing claims against these courts. But with Sesta Fosta, from your perspective, like what was your perspective on that legislation, which I should just tell people was it basically prevented the advertising of sex workers in magazines or online or
websites. So websites had kind of a free rein with the Communication Decency Act, oddly named CDA 230, allowed websites and hosts of websites and designers of websites to not be liable for anything that people post on their website.
Right.
And they interpreted that very broadly, the courts did, very, very broadly. So it was just basically immunity for the people who were making the money off of the activities that were happening, the most money off of it, they were immune. And so FOSTA SESTA took that immunity away. And I think it really pissed people off. It has pissed people off, right?
But my understanding is that some activists are like, this is problematic because this is one of the ways that we track... and help.
I think that narrative's being paid for and
really.
Yeah, I do. I think so. One of the things that I'll talk about later today is Soros Foundation and Open Society Foundation that has put billions of dollars into planting a narrative that says that the websites and that sex trafficking itself is not sex trafficking, that there's sex work, that they're empowering and there's opportunities to empower sex workers through
commercialization. Hold on 1 second. I think we're having a little bit of problem with our connectivity. Are we there, guys? Okay. All right. I'm sorry. Sorry about that. Didn't see.
It's okay.
So, to be clear, the Soros Foundation?
Yeah, and the tech industry. I mean, we've pissed them off. We've taken away a huge treat that they've had for a very long time, right?
Well, why would the Soros Foundation?
So the Soros, so they're, there's a narrative that they want to push that people who have been arrested for being victims in sex work, they need a voice. I've been giving that voice. We have a voice. We've been trying to give a voice to that. I just said I was arrested as a 12-year-old victim. That shouldn't have happened.
Right.
And I've been working against that for a very long time. What's happened is that's turned into we shouldn't arrest the buyers. We should allow pimps or managers to be able to do their job of selling people. And this full decriminalization argument has come out of the Soros Foundation. They've been behind a lot of the other full decriminalization arguments in other crimes, like around marijuana and other issues that they feel that should not be criminal. Actually, some of the people that are funded by him and some of the research that comes out says that property crimes, like if someone breaks into your home, shouldn't be a criminal act.
So just to be clear, in terms of sex work,
which I don't think exists, sex work itself. But
you don't think it?
I mean, I think you need big quotes around sex work because the dynamic and the power differential of somebody who's offering money for that piece of you, that part of you, is unequal. It's just unequal. It's unequal to an extent that doesn't make it a fair bargain at all for the person that's being purchased. So I don't consider it work.
Okay. I mean, I think that is, you know, the perspective. I mean, I think there are people who think sex work should be legalized and that
right.
having a regulatory structure will be the best way to protect people who are trafficked and who are, you know.
Which creates more victims, actually. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, that's all right. Because I just want that out there because I'm the perspective of some of the folks who are against Sesta Fosta feel that this is the only way to track what's going on for victims. How else would you find victims? Or I guess this litigation is part of that. Is like, you know,
we know where
they're at.
Yeah.
And that's part of the problem.
Yeah,
we know
where they're at.
I mean, do you have a sense as you pursue this litigation, like, how do you establish damages? How do you peg a figure on this? And is the idea that you're trying to reach people essentially like yourself who have, been victims and are obviously not currently victims right now, but need to get out of the system before they basically say, we have a claim against the hotel companies that knew this was happening in their properties and just allowed it to continue.
And took profits for it, yeah. So it's been a long road. I started telling my own story in 2006, and at that time I was uncertain about what my beliefs were around sex work, around any of it. I really didn't know. All I knew was that kids as young as 11 years old were being arrested and charged with prostitution.
Right.
And I knew that was wrong. I knew that from my own experiences, and I knew that from going and sitting with the youth. Many of them were in foster care or group homes or probation. They were kids that didn't have parents except for the state. You know, we were their parents, and we weren't doing a good job. So my advocacy has been around bringing awareness. Probably like the first 5 years of the advocacy work I've done has been bringing awareness for child victims of trafficking. For, you know, and part of my focus at that point was on Backpage early on. I mean, I was focused on the fact that this was happening. It was happening rampantly. I'd have young girls tell me, well, how could it be illegal? It's out there in the open. They really believed that. They didn't believe that it could be illegal. They thought they were partaking in something that was accepted, and it was being accepted at that point, largely, in society. So if we ignore something, it's like the broken window theory, right? Kind of, right? If we ignore it, it gets worse. It gets much worse. So, and for them to start internalizing that, oh, because it's open and out there, somehow it makes it okay that I'm a victim, means that they're going to be trapped in that for so much longer. Much, much longer. And so once we've seen services and programs now being built up because of the awareness and because there's some funding coming out for services finally, and then those services have to get mature and know how to deliver those services and learn and get evidence from what works and what doesn't work, then you start to see and start to be able to measure.
And those are services who are geared towards kids who are trafficked. So I think my conception has largely been like, society's not aware of what's going on. Mm-hmm. And it's like some type of rescue mission. You come in, you see the kids, you bring them out.
It's the Hollywood version.
And the end of the story. This is really more about kids who are in a system are not aware that they're being victimized.
Yeah.
Until they get older.
Yeah.
Because they're 12 and they just...
Right.
And so when you talk about something like Backpage, do they look at Backpage and say like, oh, I'm being advertised, so it must be fine? Or do they have a... like?
When it was...
Would a victim at this point be aware of like Sesta Fosta? Would just the idea of it...
helps prevent some of it. Yeah, it helps prevent.
They become aware like, yeah. Oh, this is illegal. I'm
a
victim.
Yes. Yes, that's what it helps, and that's where it helps. But it was a huge, it was a huge ask to go to the tech industry or to the web, you know, infrastructure of internet companies that were profiting off of posts and wanted to maintain zero liability and say, can you police yourselves, right? Can you go ahead and start doing the right thing? Can you not allow this to happen? It wasn't going to happen. And so it did take a huge, you know, and wake up call to say, no, it's not going to happen anymore. There's going to be liability. And you see that has pushed it to other places. It's still in the open. I believe that a lot of the trafficking still happens out in the open. You have websites like Seeking Arrangements and Sugar Daddy where it's happening, and there'll be lots of disclaimers. You have ways
There's presumably dating sites.
Presumably dating sites. There's... which I think are actually far worse than some of the other ones. But then there are places where it's just social media, right? It's just social media, but you know that these traffickers target certain accounts and certain people and hit them up regularly, right? And are basically fishing for victims. I mean, they get out there and they go on and befriend people. I had a young woman that, she, as soon as she turned 18, was told, oh, come be in music videos in New York, come be a part of this, and name drop some people they worked with, had some photos on the webs, on the social media site that they were contacted through. And then before you know it, she's taken out, you know, out of state from across the country, from California to New York, and then told, you know, bitch, you're going to be mine, and you owe me money now for being here and for me getting you here. And that's how, I mean, these arrangements are set up. It doesn't have to be necessarily an open site. It's still happening out in the open.
Right. How, are there syndicates of traffickers?
That work together?
Yeah. I mean, like, how is this organized? Is this a function of organized crime? Is there a...
So there are various types of, I mean, yes. Yes. So you can have everything from where the businesses, even the hotels or the hotel managers, are involved. You could have gangs that are involved and are profiting off of trafficking. That's happened multiple times, multiple cases where gangs have worked together to traffic and have that as a source of funds. You have even rival gangs that work together to traffic, to increase trafficking and the market of trafficking and increase funds. So yes, I mean...
And all right, so how will you establish, ultimately, if you find those victims, that, like as you say, as services ramp up, and organizations get in contact with start to have some type of regular contact with victims. This litigation is an opportunity for those services to say, like, we can get you a settlement essentially that will allow you to go and leave, you know, provide you with the resources to be independent, to restart your life.
And there's a hurdle when you're talking with organizations that provide services, because they have a particular set of interests for the clients. And litigation is not always easy, right? One of the goals that we have is eliminating the statute of limitations.
Right.
Why should anyone ever think, oh, I can get away with this criminal activity that's hurting other people if it just has to be that they don't come forward for years?
I imagine they're state by state. Mm-hmm. What are the statute of limitations on?
Well, the federal one is the one I'm particularly thinking of, is for the Traffic Victims Protection Reauthorization Act, the TVPRA. Right now is 10 years. So that'll be something I'm going to be looking at. And I've been talking to people who are going to propose some new changes to that, where at least let's not start that 10 years until someone realizes that they've been a victim. Because to put somebody through that while they're in the middle of going through seeking services, getting help, is really difficult. I mean, that's going to be some of our clients. Some of them are still minors. Some of them, you know, parents are outraged, like with the Backpage cases. I mean, parents were outraged and went and sought counsel because of that. So we'll hear from parents. We'll hear directly from the youth. I mean, not unlike the opioids. I mean, we should be hearing from the counties. The counties should be saying, hey, you know, we know that these companies are profiting off of this, and that it's our kids that are in our care. They're in foster care, right? They're in our care, and we have to absorb all those costs of getting them help and services, which may never happen for them, right? And so so we may hear from them as well. But it is difficult for that initial connection to happen, to say, I'm valuable.
Right.
I have rights. Or my daughter who was murdered at a motel, right? I want to fight for her. I want to bring up that memory again. I mean, that's difficult to ask people to do. And we want to be there for them during that whole process.
So where and where is it in the process at this point? Like, you've identified defendants, I guess, presumably?
Yeah.
You are looking for plaintiffs? And do you have a timeline?
I kind of have two strategies myself, okay? So we have the big brands that are out there that we're going to probably get the mass torts going. I mean, that is our goal. We're here at Mass Torts Conference. I mean, it's pretty obvious. That's what we want to see, a large number of victims recover. And that's only going to happen through this type of litigation. And I'm really excited about it. I'm excited about learning about mass torts, and that's an opportunity to go forward in that direction. Because that's how things are going to change, is through that. Now, then you have the small motel operators throughout California. We'll have hundreds that this is their main source of revenue, is from being involved in this. So I've got to think about that strategy a little bit different, because now we're not talking about a corporate brand, but we're talking about adding up all of these places where they've been harboring sex trafficking for decades and getting away with it. Some of them not under a brand, right?
Right.
So there's kind of two avenues in the hotel, motel industries that I'm thinking about. Mass torts, and then individual claims that victims can have. And maybe we have dozens of victims against one or dozens of defendants in those small motels.
To what extent is there a pursuit of legislation that would be the functional equivalent of SESTA FOSTA, but for other entities that are profiting off of this?
So,
why isn't there a federal statute that says if your motel has been the site of three three criminal activities over the course of 5 years, or you know,
it's a great argument for that. I mean, you probably know, like we know that hotels and motels have this increase. They have basically a higher duty of care for their right. for the people who are coming onto their property who they're renting rooms to. So how in the world could you know that your hotel is rampant with crime, with kidnappers, with people who potentially are rapists, murderers? You know, how could you know that and keep that door open? Really? Right. I mean, it should, and the industry standard isn't there yet in terms of policing themselves is not there yet. They're starting to do education around human trafficking, but we've seen for the last decade things be on the books and they are not doing things differently.
When motels when traffickers use motels, are the kids there for 24/7 and people are coming in to buy their services?
Yeah, so one of the things that you might see is that there'd be a number of people throughout the day who are unrelated coming in to that same room to sexually assault or rape that person.
If the motel was even vaguely vigilant about it, they could... It's fairly easy to identify what's going on.
And the sad thing that I've heard is, this is one of the smaller motels, but they had cameras on every door. They could see every door. Every door. And the children thought that was to trap them, to hold them there. They didn't see the cameras, because the cameras would see the people coming in and out all the time, right? So, and they didn't do anything about that. So the kids assumed they were being watched.
Oh, my God.
And that they weren't allowed to go in and out.
What was your reaction around the whole Jeffrey Epstein thing? What was your sense as someone who obviously now 10, 15 years working on the side of trying to help victims, having been a victim, do you have a sense of that scenario?
I hope we don't ignore it just because he's dead. I mean, what he has done will have an impact forever. I mean, really, it has an impact on the lives of the people that he harmed.
Right.
Generationally, it goes through generations after that. The number of people that participated with him that haven't been held accountable yet for the harms that they've done to those same children that he hurt, that he trafficked, is appalling. And, just the amount of time that went
unaddressed.
Unaddressed. I mean, we knew what happened. He went to prison but got released on a program where he was out every day
right.
victimizing people while he was in prison. The fact that we condoned that for so long, we need to look at ourselves as a society and say, what else are we missing?
Right.
Right? What else are we missing? And it should be an indication and a measure of us. How kids are treated should be an indication of how we are doing as a society. And we did bad in that case. And we're not the only ones, in the world that are not doing well in this. And there's no magic wand to get rid of it. But we have to address every case vigilantly and not just slap people on the wrist for buying, for procuring, for offering, for selling. And that includes every level that profits off of this.
Chris Phelps, of counsel with Levin Papantonio. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank
I really
you.
Appreciate it. Where can people go? Are there websites that you recommend or organizations that you recommend for people to get more information
about
this?
Yeah, if somebody needs resources or services, the Human Trafficking Hotline, which is 888-3737-888. That's how I memorize it, 888-3737-888. And that is the line to call, no matter if you're in need of services or if you're a service provider and you want to let people know that you're out there providing services and you want to be vetted and be on that line, then call them and get on that line. There's also a text way that people who can't call can reach them by text, and that's Be Free, which is 233-3733. That could be text, and you could text info or help to that line. And on the website, National Human Trafficking Resource, nhtrc.org, you can look up state by state what's available in your community, in your area. So that's the primary one that I would send people to.
And is there any type of activists who are pursuing legislation along this? Or?
Yeah, and they have a whole policy page for it. So, again, if you want to get involved locally, you can see where your state is, what they're doing, how they're ranked is on Shared Hope International website. But Polaris has a start to all of that information, and Polaris is the National Human Trafficking Resource Center. We'll have all that information.
All right, Chris Phelps, thank you so
thank
much for
you.
Your time today. I really
Thanks,
appreciate
Sam.
It. All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half. Thank you. Wow. So,
yes.
We're going to be talking just amazing story. We're going to be talking to other attorneys tomorrow about various product liability issues and other cases. There's been, over the years, some devastating stories that I've heard here that are really disturbing and horrific. And, you know, it's interesting to, and maybe we can talk about this more in the fun half, but the perspective, I think that, you know, we've talked about when it came to Sesta Fosta in the past, you know, it's hard to get a sense of what the best way to approach these things are. I don't necessarily agree with the idea that there's no such thing as sex work. There are sex workers who I think are, at least to my understanding, that people who make a choice as an adult to do that kind of work. But I guess, you know, different people have different perspectives on it.
Do you think maybe, I don't know if I'm up. Do you think maybe it's, I don't know. I think, you know, you and I both could use to talk to plenty of people with, you know, like the guest today of, I mean, Jesus, I don't even want to say X. I don't know what the right word would be, but people who know more than us. But I think...
victim.
Yeah, well, certainly victim, but I'm also, I mean, a victim, but also an expert.
Right.
But I think it seems to me that a term like sex work is maybe too all-encompassing because it can be used to describe potentially way too many things. And we need to start
right.
kind of disaggregating what exactly we're talking about here, right? Like some, you know, but at any rate, yeah.
Let's play one more clip as we move on. We've been talking about impeachment. Here is Eddie Glaude on MSNBC talking about impeachment. Again, 2 weeks ago, we had the text messages between Bill Taylor and Sondland, who is the EU ambassador and was picked by the Trump organization. I mean, the weird thing is that they brought in Taylor. It's almost like these guys, there was this corrupt cabal of Sondland and Volcker and Giuliani and Perry, but they also needed some expertise. So it's almost like they couldn't help but bring in a career diplomat. And of course, this Bill Taylor, and they're going to attempt to impeach this guy's credibility, but I think they're going to have a tough time.
What language they speak over there, Bill?
Well, I think it's really going to be like, so, Bill, you're the type of goody-goody who writes copious contemporaneous notes, and I see you only use single space. I mean,
what's now. I'm talking about in the beginning where they're just like, you know, I think we need someone. What do they speak, Crane over there?
Right.
Hey, Bill,
exactly.
Get over here.
We need somebody
to... We're planning
to...
something.
But here is Eddie Glaude. In the wake of the reports of what Bill Taylor has testified to, which I think, like I said, we were talking 2 weeks ago, we're pretty clear from the text that that was his disposition. But here's Eddie Glaude.
You know, Dan Balz in his column today in the Washington Post made it very clear. He says the question of whether this happened is now settled. Mm-hmm. The issue now is how the president explains it and what Congress chooses to do about it. So you're right. Something has changed. The smoking gun is here. The evidence is clear. Now we have to assess what will the Congress do. And I think that's where we are. So something has shifted. I think you and David are right. Something has shifted. The question now is, what are the next steps?
And that is the question. We'll talk more about that maybe in the fun half. I should remind you, you can say goodbye to sleepless nights. Thanks to Calm and Comfort by Sharper Image, the luxurious weighted blanket that's made with super soft velveteen material and high-density comfort fill that mimics the soothing feeling of being hugged and relaxes your body. The Calm and Comfort weighted blanket comes with a 90-day anxiety-free guarantee from Sharper Image. And right now, our listeners can go to calmandcomfortblanket.com. Use the promo code MAJORITY at checkout to receive 15% off the displayed price. Again, that's calmandcomfortblanket.com. Promo code MAJORITY. You can't put a price on a great night's sleep. Go to calmandcomfortblanket.com. Promo code MAJORITY. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break and head into the fun half. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, Kyle has been a monster, an absolute monster on updating the new app. If you updated it a couple of days ago, update it again. Has all the features that you want in terms of like pausing and returning to the same place when you're playing the podcast. You can find the AM Quickie on there. You can search the index if you're a member. Check it out. You can go to majorityapp.com to find the iOS and the Android versions and subscribe to the AM Quickie. You can do that on any of your podcast feeds. Today is Wednesday. Last night was Tuesday. Michael, what the hell went on there?
Party. Artesia Balthrop came through, talked about Chile, Lebanon, Chicago, and how the media covers different types of protests and what the different protests today are about. Why Hong Kong is about preserving important liberal freedoms in some respects, and maybe Ecuador, Haiti, Lebanon, Chile about economic freedom in a actual human, not libertarian sense. Talked about a whole bunch more, so I'll keep it brief. I recorded an interview I'm incredibly excited about and proud of with Adolf Reed, which is going to go up to patrons today. They'll get an early peek at it before we release it publicly in a couple weeks. Patreon.com/TMBS. Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Snag your tickets to Philly. The link's on the website.
Jamie? Is Jamie there? I can't see on the camera.
She's not, no. But okay. Check out the Antifada, folks.
And Matt, I presume you're there?
I am here. I'll be doing the Salem Witch Trials for a future Saturday Literary Hangover episode. So we're going to be talking about Cotton and Increase Mather. We're going to be talking about inequality and a commercial versus a secular society fighting through the church and gender and inequality. And so check that out, folks, on Saturday.
Oh, and folks, don't forget, we want, if you... we're building a glossary of things that you hear on the show that you just feel like, I don't get what they're talking about. What is this? Why does Michael do a right-wing Nelson Mandela impression? Where did that come from? Things like that. If you want to know.
It's like apartheid.
Send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Put in the subject meme. Or memes, M-E-M-E-S, memes, and we will include it in our glossary so that people can follow what the hell we're talking about half the time. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danarchy's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danarchy.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, folks. Reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
Hell out of back. Hell out of back. Hell out of back. Hell out of back. Hell out of back.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black. African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on!
Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them! Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black.
Blast me around here.
I am a total
pussy.